You've heard before that the best way to succeed is to find a need and fill it. Well, that is exactly what our guest on today's episode of Pursuing Profit with Principles has done. Todd DePostino is founder and executive director of the Veterans Breakfast Club. He comes from the world of academia as a historian and a professor. He's taken his love of history and his appreciation of our American veterans and coupled that with a nonprofit organization that not only serves veterans, but gives them a voice. Welcome back to Pursuing Profit with Principles. We're so glad that you're joining us today. And as always, I have an amazing guest on the show today. I might have the most fun job on the planet. I get to interview all these wonderful people and bring you their stories. And I just love doing that. So let me tell you a little bit about our guest today. This is Todd DePostino. He is the founder and executive director of the Veterans Breakfast Club. I just love the title of that, by the way. And they hold veteran storytelling programs that are open to the public. Awesome. He has a PhD in American history from Yale University. And he's the author of the award-winning Bill Maudlin, A Life Up Front. I want to hear more about that and several other books. So welcome to the show, Todd. So glad you're here today.
I'm glad I'm here too. Thank you, Regina. And I would disagree with you just right off the bat. Okay. I have the most interesting job because I get to ask veterans all about their experiences and just hear their stories all day long.
I love it. I love it. Yeah. So yeah, that's a hard one to top. Yeah. That is a hard one to top. So great. Well, we want to dive right in and hear all about you because, you know, my listeners get to listen to me all the time. We want them to hear all about you. So would you tell us a little bit about your journey? What yeah. brought you here and yeah. who I mean, does you serve and why?
It's a crooked journey as most, I think, interesting journeys are. And it started for me in 2008. I was teaching history at some colleges. I was writing some books. And I wrote a book that had to do with World War II. It was a biography of Bill Maudlin, who used to be a celebrity, a household name. He's not anymore. But he did these gritty, realistic combat cartoons of the life up front in Europe, of what it was like mm-hmm. to serve up front in war. And I'd been seeing the cartoons and I had really admired them, and I admired his writing, and I admired that Bill Maudlin kind of did what the great correspondent Ernie Pyle did. Maudlin did in pictures what Pyle did in words, is he delivered this world of the combat soldier back home to people at the home front who really didn't understand what serving in war or even the military was all about. Right. And working on that book, I learned a lot. I saw a kind of side to military service. I'm not a veteran. I don't come from a military family. But I grew in my understanding of what serving in the military means for people, not only while they serve, but for the rest of their lives. Yeah. Maudlin, he made fun of the Army. He hated the Army at times, but he also loved the Army. The Army was his family. Yeah. Or a second family for him. And the book came out and I went out and started giving talks, and I found that the people who came to my talks in support of the book were generally veterans, many of them World War II veterans. And I would give my talk on Maudlin, and we would go to Q&A time, and they would start sharing their stories. And what they had to say was a lot more interesting than anything I had to say. And a friend of mine named Dan Cavanaugh had a group of 30 World War II veterans that he got together. He met them on a trip to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. And he invited me to come speak to them. I spoke to them. And afterwards, I saw how Dan just carried this wireless microphone through the room and had each veteran stand up and share a story.
Awesome.
It was absolutely gripping. I mean, these stories, these veterans, they grabbed me by the lapel, figuratively, and would not let me go. I mean, it was like they were reading scripts, you know, from a Hollywood movie, but they weren't. These were, you know, these were stories from the front lines of history. These were, these were expertly crafted tales, showing kind of glimpses of what their service in the military entailed. And it was exhilarating to me. It was fascinating to me after somebody, you know, I'm somebody who spends a lot of time alone in the archives. And you get to, after a while, you get to believe that history lives in the archives. It lives on the paper,
right.
But it doesn't. It lives in our memories. It lives in our bodies. It lives in our culture. And to actually see it alive, you know, in a room full of people was exhilarating in a way that I think I hadn't anticipated. And that was the beginning of the Veterans Breakfast Club. It really was. We just started getting them together every month and invited their families to join us. And a strange thing happened shortly after we started scheduling these is after a 2-hour session with these veterans, one of the wives, spouses came up to me afterwards and grabbed me by the hand and said, "Thank you so much for doing this. We've been married 60 years. I've never heard any of the stories that he told today."
Yeah.
And it just struck me like we are doing something here that's really valuable for the veterans, their families, and for us, the non-veterans.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was the beginning.
That's amazing. So two things I would say. One, it sounds like it was life-changing for you as well. And the second is that I think he didn't grab you by the lapel. I think he grabbed you by the heart.
Yeah, that's it. And they, I guess I felt like they were grabbing me by the throat because I didn't want to be grabbed. I had an okay life. I didn't need this. You know, I mean, I didn't need to like form a nonprofit and spend all that. I had no idea where it was going. I didn't have I thought, okay, I'll make a book out of this. And I never did. You know, I was kind of casting for a reason apart from my just loving the experience to grow the Veterans Breakfast Club. And I really couldn't find one. I mean, we were just a bootstrap operation, seat of the pants operation. Literally, we began with, people would come in 8:30 in the morning, would have a buffet breakfast at a hotel ballroom. They would pay cash at a front desk. I would store the cash in a shoebox under the lectern and then run a whole program for, at that time, it was 2 hours. And then I would go to the front desk of the hotel and kind of give them the shoebox and say, you know, give me any change you have left over. And that was how we did things for a while. So it was all volunteer. Excuse me?
What year did you start?
2008, 2009.
2008. That's right.
Yeah. We're not incorporated. Yeah. We're not a nonprofit. We're not, you know, it's a hobby. And it's one I really didn't need because I was busy enough.
Right.
So I kind of felt that it was grabbing me by the throat. But it was so compelling to me and so important. And so it was invigorating in a way that I hadn't anticipated. It was like I knew that there was something at work in me that was, I was becoming a better person.
Right.
Kind of spending a couple hours being quiet.
Yeah.
And really listening to people, you know, listening with my heart and not just with my ears.
Right.
And encouraging other people to do the same.
Yeah.
And every event, I mean, I'm telling you, Regina, we would have these events and every single time there would be tears. Every single time there would be a lot of laughter. And it was like you were getting the full range of the human drama, you know, the comedy, the tragedy. All there in these veteran stories. And it was just like this window into just the human experience that a lot of people found compelling. And it wasn't just me. We were starting to get really big crowds coming to these things. And so I knew by, you know, spring 2009 that we were kind of on to something. I just didn't know quite what it was.
Right. And so what did that journey look like figuring out what it was?
Yeah, it meant, it's an interesting, for me, it meant a lot of negotiation. And I'll just jump right into the entrepreneurial aspect of it. I realize now that one of my character traits that was important is that I'm a super agreeable person and I love consensus. I love working in groups. I have a hard time saying no. I have a hard time, you know, kind of, I guess pushing my will or my, you know, vision forward. So it took a lot longer, I think, to form. If I had been a little bit more less agreeable, if I had been a little bit more determined, focused, I think things would have happened more quickly. But my goal at first was simply to build consensus and to get a good big team of volunteers together. And we made a lot of mistakes along the way, I think, because of that, because, you know, one of the key things you need to do when you start a company, or I think, or a nonprofit, is, or write a book or do any endeavor, you need to really focus on what the end goal is. Mm-hmm. You know, what is the goal? What is the outcome you're looking for? And it's very easy. It sounds simple, but it's really not. Defining your goal, defining your mission,
right,
is not that simple.
It is not.
There are things that could knock you off really easy. So for example, you know, our mission going to be? Our mission is going to be that have veterans share stories. Okay. Well, you know what? I've heard that there are veterans in the state veterans home who need socks. We should do a sock drive. There's this legislation in Congress for veterans benefits. You know, we should come out and help promote it. There are all these things that come at you, all these other demands that are pulling you in different directions. And me being kind of a yes man, being agreeable, I'd be open to all of these. And I found that we were really suffering from mission drift, you know, from mission creep, that our mission was beginning to dissipate. And that was like an early lesson that, okay, this is going to take some organization and some formalization of how we administer these programs. And that really led directly to the, you know, creation of a nonprofit, incorporation, you know, applying to the IRS for 501c3 status, developing a board that would protect the mission and operations. And so we kind of formalized up by 2010 or 2011.
It's so powerful. I'm really glad you went down that road, because having that strategic direction, whether you're for profit or nonprofit, is so critical. And you have to establish that up front. You've got to create the strategic direction. Otherwise, as you say, you get that mission creep or mission drift. And it, you know, in the entrepreneurial world, we call it shiny object syndrome.
Yes.
And you're grabbing at things all the time, and you're spending a ton of time and money and missing out on the real opportunities because you're grabbing all these shiny objects. If you have that strategic direction, you know what your, I'm going to call it our market dominating position, to use our language, but you know what it is you do, and you can clearly express that, and you know who your ideal client is, it makes shiny object syndrome non-existent.
Yes.
Because now you're able to look at everything and say, this fits my mission or it doesn't. It may be great. It may be wonderful, just as some of those things that you were describing, but it doesn't fit my mission. So I'm going to let that one go. This one over here fits. Yeah. I'm going to grab that one.
Absolutely. And the strategy could change, you know, the strategic vision can change with time, but it should be a deliberate process.
Yes.
And I think it's important in hindsight, it's important for people to understand who they are when they're getting involved in this. I'm the kind of person that could be pulled from the focus of the mission. You know, I'm very happy to kind of follow other people down a road. So I needed a strong board.
Right.
I needed a strong organization and a structure that would keep me on track so that I could say when I get a phone call from a veteran I love, you know what? We would love for you to get involved in this project that we're doing. You know, I could say, I'd love to, Wilbur, but my board just won't let me.
Yeah.
You know, I needed that. Yeah, I needed that backup. I needed that backup.
Understood. And that's so true. We do need to know who we are in that. And we need to surround ourselves with people who have a different strength than we do.
Yeah. I tell you, this entrepreneurial or social entrepreneurial journey is really one of self-discovery, because I just felt like all my strengths were certainly exposed. Like, hey, this guy could really get veterans to open up and talk. That's great. What a gift that is. That's so terrific. You're such a great guy. But man, your weaknesses are exposed also.
Yeah, absolutely.
Big time. Like, you don't know how to bookkeeping. You know, boy, you have a strange management style. You know, I mean, you really, you know, it's, you get exposed, and it's it's a real education.
Yeah, humbling too.
Humbling. That's what it is. That is humbling.
It is definitely humbling. Yes. And you know, it's a really good point though too, because you have your board of directors that keeps you accountable. Most entrepreneurs don't have that.
Exactly.
They lack accountability.
Exactly.
And sometimes the only time that accountability comes in is when the bank statement comes in.
Yes.
When the banker calls and says, "Hey, you know, your account's empty. You're late on your mortgage, on this loan payment," whatever that is, that outside accountability. And so as entrepreneurs, we need to make sure that we are building some accountability in to our business. We're, yes. You know, it's kind of they leave a world where they're totally accountable to other people, whether it's the military or yes. whether it's working in corporate America or working for someone else, they're totally accountable for what they're doing. And they leave that world and come into entrepreneurship going, freedom.
Yeah.
Realized, you know, but they unshackle themselves from any accountability in the process. And that yes. can be very damaging.
Freedom is a dangerous thing and a scary thing. I mean, freedom is great. I mean, as an entrepreneur, I love it. Absolutely yeah. love it. But man, you know, you're out there on your own in many you respects. Are. And even in the nonprofit world, even when you have a mandated board of directors, it is still, I would tell other nonprofit leaders, you really do have to treat your organization as a social entrepreneurial endeavor, because the relationship with the board is a very strange one in the nonprofit world. The line of authority, the legal line of authority is, you know, the board can fire you, the executive director and right. the CEO of the nonprofit at any time. And yet the board is kind of like, you know, they're not really hands-on. They don't really know the business. They don't right. know what's going on. They don't know the programming. You're really in charge and you're really responsible. The CEO, the entrepreneur, the executive director is, here's the big lesson I found, is responsible for the culture of the organization.
Yes,
to absolutely. To define and protect and defend the culture of the organization.
Yeah, excellent point. Excellent point. You know, once one of the businesses that I had, I gathered a group of advisory board members for me, because yes. I had some big decisions to make that were good. Out of my realm of expertise.
Yep.
I owned a bed and breakfast, and my husband had passed away, and I was buying the home next door to us to turn into a lake house rental. He and I were looking at that before he passed. We had an appointment for like 2 weeks after he passed. So I went ahead and kept that appointment, but I brought my daughter, who had architectural knowledge, and decided, okay, I'm going to go ahead and do this. Well, I embarked upon about a 8-10 month project of remodeling that house. And it was like, okay, I need some advisors. I need some folks who have expertise in areas I don't. So I reached out to a retired banker who'd been a really good friend over the years. And I reached out to, you know, several other people and said, I need people that I can springboard ideas off of at the moment, because I don't have expertise in all of these areas. Now, my husband, he would have been able to handle that remodel project perfectly.
Right.
And the interesting thing was, a little sidebar here, I prayed that I would have his brain, you know, his yeah. faculties while doing that project. And months into the project, or even after it finished, I can't recall, and I thought, you know, that prayer was answered. I didn't have any stumbles as we were going through that. Everything went pretty smoothly. And, you know, but I was surrounded by good people. And we do need to surround ourselves around good people as an entrepreneur.
Absolutely. Because
you can't know it all.
Mm-mm.
And I, you know, something my listeners have heard me say before is that entrepreneurs don't know what they don't know. We
right.
come from a world of working for someone else, again, whether it's the military or if it's, you know, public, private, corporate America. We're working for someone else and we think we see what they're doing, but we don't. And we don't know what it takes to run a business, to really create a solid foundation, that you're building a legacy here. You're building something that you can sell when you're ready to leave that world, or, you know, right. dispose of in some way that's profitable for you, that's advantageous. And the problem with not knowing what we don't know is we don't know what questions to ask or who to ask it of.
You bet. You bet. Yeah. And you only kind of learn the questions to ask by doing the work. So that's another thing that I recommend to nonprofit leaders or people who are starting out, and maybe they have an idea for a nonprofit or a company that they have. I recommend that they start doing the work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Start doing the work. You know, you could certainly need to plan, you need to, you know, discuss it, you need to incorporate, take some first steps, But you have to start doing the work. Yeah. And as you do the work, you begin to see what you don't know. You begin to learn what you don't know.
Right.
And then you could really grow.
Right. That's and when then you can really reach out to sources that can help you. Yeah.
I've run across people who have planned on founding a nonprofit, but they wanted to be fully funded, you know, before they ever started. And most of those projects never really get off the ground because they're so into planning, they haven't really tested the idea.
Yeah. I'm a huge proponent of imperfect action is better than no action.
Yep, I agree.
Get out there and take some action. You'll figure it out along the way.
Yeah, and you'll screw up. You'll make mistakes. You'll waste time. But it's all so important to do. Otherwise, you really don't know. Well, there are so many things you need to learn. And what entrepreneurs are delivering for the most part are things that other people for some reason aren't. You know, you're seeing a need, you're seeing a demand, you're seeing something out there in the market or out there in the world, a need that needs to be met and that isn't being met in quite the right way or quite the way that you envision.
Yeah.
And so because kind of by definition, what you're doing is new, you're not going to know it. You're not going to know what it is.
Yeah.
That's one of the amazing things about life is you get to do things and you don't even quite know what you're doing, but you just know that it's like what you need to be doing at that moment.
Yeah.
And that's
absolutely.
You need to follow that vision, that passion, that instinct kind of.
So what do you say to someone, Todd, who is embarking on this pathway? What do you say to them relative to the bumps in the road, that it's not all pleasant being an entrepreneur? No matter how much you love it, it has its moments of difficulty. How do you help them prepare for that?
Well, you tell them that there are going to be bumps. It's going to be hard because anything in life that's worth doing is going to be hard.
Yeah.
If it's not hard, if there are no bumps, do something else.
Yeah.
Where there are bumps, you want the bumps. You want the challenges. You want the obstacles because then you know that what you're doing is worthwhile. I mean, the world is filled with objects of friction. The world is filled with, you know, we're not on a glide path through life. We struggle, we battle through it. And I think if you're really living your life, you're really battling through it. I don't mean it's like every day is a struggle and you're, you know, in a miserable mood, but it's a challenge commensurate with your ability and your, you know, your inspiration. So I would say that you kind of want to invite the obstacles in the sense that you want to do something, you want to have your mission be meaningful enough that there's going to be resistance out there.
I love that.
I mean, so for example, the baseline resistance out there for me, veterans don't like to talk about their service, especially to civilians, especially to people who have no idea, can't even imagine what it's like to be in war. So that's the struggle. That's going to be the problem. And are we going to, I'm going to have a veteran storytelling event. Am I going to have a veteran stand up who has nothing to say or doesn't want to talk? Yeah, that's going to be awkward for a room full of 100 people. And you have a veteran here that doesn't want to talk about it. That's not going to be, you know, that's going to be an awkward moment.
Yeah.
So you got to battle through that. You've got to find a way to either kind of coax a story out of him or her, or to, you know, be graceful in the moment and move on to the next thing. I mean, those are all things that you just learn as you go. And it's, I think you have to be ready in life. And I started this relatively late in life. I'm 55 years old right now. So, you know, I was in my 40s. I think if I were to have tried this in my 20s, I wouldn't have been ready for it. It would have been too much for me. But I was at a point where I had, I guess, enough success in the academic scholarly world that I was old enough, and you feel your brain kind of, you know, calcifying at middle age. Up for something. Yeah. I was up for something that would really be a challenge, that would really kind of light up parts of my brain that I hadn't used very much. And that was the Veterans Breakfast Club.
So one of the things I'm hearing you say is that growth comes from the struggles.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely.
Embrace them.
If there's no struggle, no growth.
No struggle, no growth. So embrace the opportunities. Condition.
Yeah. Embrace
the challenge. Each challenge brings opportunities.
Young vets say, young people in the military now say, embrace the suck.
Yes, and I've heard that.
That's what they mean. That's what it means. There's a lot of wisdom in military jargon. There really is.
There is.
There's a lot of BS in it too, but there's a lot of wisdom in it. And one of them is embrace the suck. And what that means is like, this is important. What you're doing is important.
Right.
Yeah, you don't want to be scrubbing pots in the desert in a tent.
Right.
But you know what? If this mission is going to be successful, those pots need to be clean. They need to, these troops need to be fed, and you got to scrub them.
Yeah.
And it's that's embracing the suck. That's doing the job. That's not necessarily easy, but it's a meaningful one.
Yeah. Absolutely. Oh, this has been awesome. We could go on at this for a long time, I'm sure. But what I'd like to do now is transition over to our famous three questions that we ask of all of our guests and get your responses on that, on these. So let's just dive right in. So our first one is, what is a leadership principle that has served you well in your life and business?
Oh, leadership principle that has served me well. Because there are leadership principles that haven't served me too well. But a leadership principle that has served me well, you know, and I don't know if this is a principle, but it's something I do. It's something I do and believe in.
Okay.
I haven't assessed whether it's actually served me well. I believe that as a leader, leaders should do some of the dirty work. It's kind of just what we were talking about a few moments ago, should do some of the ordinary mundane jobs, you know, check the voicemail, do the callbacks, you know, check in on at our events, how's the food? Is everybody greeting people at the door, making them feel welcome? You know, things that you could even have even an intern do, right? Thank you notes. You know, do the little things that are really a part of your operation just to remind yourself how the operation goes and what you depend on to make the operation go smoothly. So I, you know, there are certain things, certain parts of the job that I just don't enjoy. I think, you know, I don't, I truly everything but talking to the vets, I don't really enjoy, but it's things that I know I need to do to understand the business and to kind of grow as a leader.
And I would ask you also, not only to understand and grow, but also to appreciate the person who does it normally.
Yep. Yep. And
more
to
appreciation.
Yes, exactly. And to appreciate the people who do it normally. And and to realize, wow, making those callbacks, that's an important job. Some of those people that you're calling, you know, they haven't talked to people in a while, or they really are hurting, or they're struggling, or they have a question, or they're confused, and you're helping them. I mean, it reminds you of the people the organization depends on.
Yeah. It can also, as you step into those roles periodically, can also help you troubleshoot processes and procedures, policies, things that as you do it, you may be going, oh, wait a minute, we could make this easier by X. This is unnecessary. We don't need to be doing this. This we should be doing. And so it helps you refine those processes and procedures.
Very, very true. Very true. Yeah. I mean, and I'll just give you one quick example. The callback thing comes to mind. We have a voicemail, and you know, I gave it to a new employee, the job, check the voicemail every day. And it was great because I didn't have to, you know, worry about the phone calls, take notes and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And after a few weeks, I thought, you know what, I've got to check the voicemail. And I listened to the outgoing message, and it was out of date. It wasn't quite the right thing, but you know, with COVID-19, I mean, you know, you need to check in on different parts of the organization and make sure it's all functioning well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have a program that for our clients that is a 52-week e-learning system. And so it takes them from vision to having their foundation for a 7-figure business in place. Week by week lessons, and they are foundational. And you know, you can't jump from week one to week 26 because you won't have the infrastructure built.
Right.
But a lot of folks go right back to week one again the next year.
Yep.
and look at it from just starting with the vision again. Okay, do we need to make any shifts? Are we in line? Is everything working here? And then going right back through that market dominating position again and our ideal client, because things change.
Yep. Things change and you change.
Yeah,
things change and you change. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, completely agree. Awesome. Second question. I would say that you are pursuing your purpose and passion at this point, correct?
Correct.
How does that impact the success of what you're doing?
Oh, I think it's huge. I mean, I'll put false modesty aside, and as you could, hear in my voice, I have a certain passion or charisma about this issue,
right?
Because it's just so deeply important to me, and I think it does come off. Other people pick up on it, and they are energized by it and inspired by it,
right?
But I think you also have to remember that charismatic leadership is probably the weakest form. And because, once the charismatic leader is gone or has been exposed or whatever, what's left? That you need more than charismatic leadership. You need real demonstrable, skilled leadership, hands-on leadership. But that passion, I think, is really important in selling your mission to people who can support it and help you, and getting people on board. Yeah, getting people on board.
That was it. It attracts, right? Your passion attracts people that are going to be interested in supporting that project.
It's
a natural attraction.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely, 1,000%. People, and some people aren't, inspired by it. And that's absolutely fine. I have a lot of very close friends who don't get don't get what I do. They just think it's, cause weird thing. But other people get it right away. And those are the people who are going to come and, really, really help expand the vision and the mission.
Right. Very good. Now, we know you're a not-for-profit organization. But it takes money to run a not-for-profit organization. Doesn't mean that you're just, pulling all that money out of your pockets. So this one, we may have to tweak this question a little bit, but I think it does still apply, just maybe slightly tweaked. And the question is, what is one profit strategy that you've used in your business?
Yeah, no, I absolutely think, obviously a nonprofit, means that you can't scoop money from revenue from the operations, but the operations need to be funded, and you certainly need a capital reserve, I think, to have a healthy, strong nonprofit. And so you need to make money. You need to have a revenue plan. You need to have a business plan. And any nonprofit that does not have a good business plan or revenue plan, they're in trouble. Lots of nonprofits depend on one revenue source, and that's a problem.
I think
the single best thing that we ever did, and it was not deliberate, was to develop a variety of revenue sources so that if one dries up, we're not out of business. And that has happened over 13 years. I mean, we have a nice variety of sponsorships, a lot of individual donations, some grant money. And all that together makes a thriving operation. And every year, one of those will go down and, we'll lose a grant because a foundation has changed its priorities, or we'll lose a sponsorship because they moved on or closed up shop or whatever. But I think a diversity of revenue is really important, whether you're a nonprofit or a for-profit. Can I tell you just a quick little story?
Please.
That was so instructive. This was an early lesson. And this is how dumb I was when we were starting the Veterans Breakfast Club. So I'm going around the room, the banquet room, with the microphone. I'm having World War II veterans share these stories. And I mean, there are stories of their ships being sunk and they're in the water for hours and they're saved. And I mean, and a younger middle-aged man, I should say, once the microphone, stands up and he starts pitching he's a marketing guy for a retirement community. And I'm so angry at him. He's kind of broken the whole vibe of the event.
Yeah.
He's selfishly taking the the time at the microphone, you know, and I was so angry. And afterwards, it just like, you know, pissed me off. So afterwards, I'm kind of complaining about it. And one person there said, like, charge them. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's how this works. That's how this works. Like, this is how dumb I, you know, I'm a scholar. I'm an academic. I'm a historian. I don't think like a business person.
Right.
I was thinking of the stories. I wasn't thinking so much of the revenue. That to me, like a light went on.
Yeah.
And that illuminated the whole landscape. I began to understand, okay, these veterans, they're my crew, but they're also a market. Yes. And if we want to keep this thing going, we have to charge for access to this market.
Yeah.
And I was afraid, how will the veterans react? They totally got it. They understood. They knew that the, you know, this was a time-consuming, labor-intensive operation that needed to be supported.
You know, there's a really good story. I love that. But it makes me think also two things. One is you were talking about having multiple streams of revenue sources. And in the private sector, we reference that as that you shouldn't have one client be more than 15% of your total, right, your total base. The other thing is you made me think about joint ventures. And there's an analogy to joint ventures and affiliates to upstream and downstream. So if you're standing in the middle of the river, right, the water's coming from upstream and it washes over you, you get wet, you keep some of that water, right? Mm-hmm. And the rest of it goes on downstream. In marketing and in joint ventures, that's the people who serve your client before they're ready for your services are those upstream folks. They service them and then they send them downstream. You service them. That's the getting wet and keeping some of that water, right? Keeping some of that. And then you send them on to that marketing guy who had a veteran's retirement home.
Right.
Upstream, downstream.
Right.
And you make partnerships on both sides of that river, both the upstream and the downstream. You make partnerships that allow you to serve that client better in a spectrum of services, you know, whole spectrum of services.
Amen, Regina. I could have used you 10 years ago. Where were you 10 years?
Well, I'm here now.
But that's exactly true. I really needed somebody. And that's where you discover your weakness. Like, I don't know how to handle the situation. And you get somebody in who has that kind of aptitude.
But you know what? 10 years ago, I couldn't have explained that to you. So, you know, we're both good. We both groaned.
Right.
Oh, very good. Very good. This has been fun. Now, I know we talked about an offer that you have for our listeners. So I'd love for you to take a moment and share that with us now, what you have for them.
Yeah, it's a magazine. It's the VBC magazine, the Veterans Breakfast Club magazine. We publish it quarterly. We used to call it a newsletter. Since then, we flatter ourselves and call it a magazine because it's grown to all of 28 pages, maybe 32. And I would be happy to send out, they're filled with veteran stories. I mean, our cover story for this latest issue is the story of a 100-year-old Navy wave, a woman who was in the Navy in World War II, and she was a code breaker working on Enigma. It's a fascinating story.
Wow.
She has come to our events for many years, and now she joins us on our virtual events several times a week. She's a real living treasure. She's our cover story, but we have a lot of other stories. War letters are in there. Young veteran stories are in there. And I'd be happy to send one out to anybody who wants one. It's
that would be great.
It's a very, very gripping, good read. You'll enjoy it. And I'll make sure that I'll send you our quarterly magazine each time.
Awesome. So we'll have that in the show notes. You'll have that information. Would you also, Todd, just take a moment and give us a little bit about your schedule of your breakfast club, your Veterans Breakfast Club? So if anybody would like to join you in that. Yes. I'm assuming that's open for everybody, right?
Yes. And that is so key. Thank you for reminding me, Regina.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we really pride ourselves that we want non-veterans to attend our events. This is so important. We need storytellers, need story listeners.
Yes.
So we need people like me to ask the stupid questions, you know, to ask the who haven't served in the military and are curious and want to hear more.
Right.
So about 40% of the people who attend our events are non-veterans. And anybody who wants to attend can simply go to our website, check out our schedule. We do 3 virtual programs a week. So you could join us on Zoom. You could join us on Facebook Live, on YouTube Live. We'd love you to join us in the Zoom room so we could actually talk with you and interact. We will have veterans from all over the world and country and certainly the world, all ages, all branches of service, every background you can imagine, men and women, people who liked it, people who didn't like it. You'll hear everything. And they're just like our in-person events used to be before COVID-19. You know, there's always a lot of laughter. There are always a few tears, always inspiration, education, you know, community, healing. It all takes place here in the Zoom room. You can just go to our website, veteransbreakfastclub.org, and connect to us and get our schedule. You could always email me too at todd@veteransbreakfastclub.org if you have any questions.
Excellent. And we will make sure all of that is in the show notes. One final comment that I was thinking about as you were talking there at the end is that you being a historian by trade, by education, by however that would be properly said, this has to be amazing from your perspective to get to hear firsthand historical accounts of things that took place in our nation and for our nation. It has to be the most incredible experience to sit there in that room. I can't even imagine. I would be, you know, crying the whole time.
Yeah. Exhilarating. Absolutely. Yeah. I am often left speechless.
I can imagine.
Just absolutely speechless. I mean, the things that we had, you know, Larry Kirby, Iwo Jima survivor, 97 years old. He joined us from Massachusetts. I'll never forget. He said, this is virtually on Zoom. He told a horrible story of combat on Iwo Jima, the worst kind of bloodiest, awful combat. He ended up in a psych ward because of it. And he said, I'm so glad I did it. And I said, Larry, I got to tell you. That seems crazy to me. I mean, what a horrible experience Iwo Jima was. And he said, yeah, but I learned one important thing. I said, what was it? He said, the importance of love.
Mm.
That there's something more important than life. I was willing to die for my comrades, for my fellow Marines on Iwo Jima. They did die for me.
Right.
And I've never been the same since. I know that there's something much more important than my life. And I know it only because I went through the suffering of Iwo Jima.
Yeah.
What do you say after that? What a gift.
Silence.
What a gift, you know, that he gave all of us.
Yeah. Yeah, that's incredible. I'm going to have to hop on these. I know my husband has been on them lately. And we just found out about you. So, you know, you haven't been in our life terribly long. But he's been joining and enjoying it. And I will have to make some time to get in there on those as well. Because it's a marvelous thing that you're doing. I'm so excited to be able to bring you to our listeners. And I know that they took away a lot of good nuggets today on business, but also just upon your project and what you're doing. So thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you, Regina.
Awesome. Folks, thanks for joining us again for this episode. And we'll be back again soon. Have an amazing day. Bye for now. Thanks for listening today. As you can see, all entrepreneurs experience challenges in their business. Most of them have worked their way through them with the help of a trusted coach. So let me ask you, what's the biggest challenge in your business? Are you generating the profit that you desire? Do you know what systems you need in order to create more efficiency and profit in your business? Are you tired of working 60 plus hours a week and not seeing the returns? Are your relationships suffering because of the stress that you're experiencing? If any of this describes you, then schedule your 90-minute profit acceleration analysis with me today for only $97. This is a special price for my listeners only. The value of this call is easily over $2,000. We will find between $10,000 and $100,000 profit in your business and lay out a roadmap for you to be able to overcome all of these problems. So get your life and your profit back on track. Schedule your profit acceleration analysis today. There is no obligation, and I'm not going to do some hard sell with you. However, if you want my help to achieve the results from your blueprint, I'm happy to have that conversation with you about what that would look like. So schedule your call today. The link is below in the show notes. Our next episode, as I interview Simo Legal. While on a development retreat in Malaysia, Simo gathered many insights that led him to found SL Design, which focuses on brand strategy and production, as well as business development. Simo, who is particularly passionate about working with coaches, trainers, and speakers, athletes, fitness centers, nutrition and clothing brands, and personal trainers, has seen the importance of branding firsthand during his career. Simo decided to dedicate his efforts towards helping businesses in the speakers and fitness space to build brand credibility, professional alignment, and to carve out a memorable persona with their target market. His firm belief in the importance of building and cultivating relationships in business has helped him to continue growing and evolving his business.